What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show today, Tuvalu's climate change minister slams the use of the term climate migrants.
I think it's totally disrespectful. It changed the whole narrative. As if we are giving up, as if we are leaving Tuvalu because of climate change, as if we are throwing in the white towel.
Vanuatu's Minister for Climate Change, Ralph Riggenvanu, has been chosen as Island's Business Person of the Year. And Google is set to build 3 new undersea cables for Papua New Guinea.
There is a lot of activity happening with regard to cables being laid in the Pacific Islands region at this time. The cable map is fast evolving and changing.
Those stories and more coming up here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific, and coming to you from the lands of the Pumarang people. We start in Papua New Guinea, where attempts to refloat a stranded Australian cruise ship are expected to resume this morning, 2 days after the grounding of the Coral Adventurer. PNG officials say the 80 passengers on board are safe and there's no visible damage to the vessel, which ran aground off the coast of the city of Lae. Morobe Provincial Police Commander Chief Superintendent Samson Siguyaru says the Lae Water Police were among the first to respond to the incident, and he told the ABC's Evan Wasuka that an attempt to refloat the cruise ship on Sunday was unsuccessful.
Australian High Com have engaged Pacific Marine tugboat to go there and try to refloat the boat. Unfortunately, they were unable to pull the boat out of the reef, and also one of the engines to the tugboat had encountered some engine. It was heated up, so they were unable to get a boat, you know, towed out from the reef. They will go back tomorrow, as I was told by our officers on the ground with the Maritime Safety Authorities, and to try one more time to get the boat afloated.
When were you first alerted by this incident involving the Coral Adventurer?
I was informed about the incident at 2 o'clock, roughly at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, by one of my officers by the name of Chris. He's the OIC for Water Police.
And what details were you given at that time?
Yeah, I was just briefly informed about the incident, that the ship which departed from Cairns in Australia was transiting through Morobe, Medan and Sibuk provinces when the incident occurred. At around about that time, about 5:30 in the morning, the vessel was passing through Draghaven, or the Finsofen point, and the vessel was affected by strong sea currents and subsequently became grounded on a reef. That's the information I got, and our good water police officers responded to the incident upon advice by the NMSA, and they arrived on site at about 11 o'clock in the morning, accompanied by one of the officers from the National Maritime Authority.
Were there any injuries or any damage to the vessel as far as your team is aware?
No. According to the report, the vessel was in good condition. There was nothing of the sort being reported by National Maritime Safety Authorities. As soon as the National Maritime, they just went, officers arrived, they just went through the, they checked through all the documents, and all the documentation is, you know, verified with the ship's captain. And then the boat was okay. And our security officers were, three of our police officers were left on board to provide security while the officers, the our water police and NMSA returned with, and soon after, before they left, they issued the detention notice to the ship, yeah, to the boat.
Can you explain a bit about that notice, what it means?
Detention notice is it's a detention of a ship because of the situation, the incident that happened, and that notice is issued as unseaworthy or substandard, that the boat, the ship must not move or move out of the location until all the processes are cleared according to the maritime NMSA process done, and then the boat can be released by the same authority, the NMSA.
In terms of the passengers, do you know if they'll keep on staying on board the ship, or will they be offloaded and taken to land, or what's your understanding of the situation?
Not really necessary. It depends on the crew, the captain, and the officers on board, if they decide. Otherwise, it's all safe there, and the officers are quite happy with they've provided accommodation facilities for our police officers, and they're still on board. There's no request from officers to come out of the ship. They all remain in the ship as we speak.
Morobe Provincial Police Commander Chief Superintendent Samson Siguyaru speaking there to the ABC's Evan Wasuka. Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Monday morning. Now, Tuvalu's climate change minister has slammed the labelling of Tuvaluans as climate migrants as disrespectful and colonial. Minister Maina Talia has criticised news organisations for describing Tuvaluans moving to Australia under the Falapili Treaty as refugees or migrants, saying the language strips away dignity and sovereignty. It comes after the ABC republished a story by Reuters that the minister passionately condemned in a Facebook post. This year marks the first year of the Falapili Union Treaty, a landmark agreement between Tuvalu and Australia that includes a migration pathway allowing up to 280 Tuvaluans to move to Australia each year. And I spoke with Minister Talia about his concerns.
No, I think basically the article for me, personally, and also as a climate minister, I think it's totally disrespectful having that that comment on migrants, on climate migrants. It really changed the narrative. A climate including migrant, it changed the whole narrative, as if we are giving up, as if we are leaving Tuvalu because of climate change, as if we are throwing in the white towel. But I think everything is premature at the moment. And almost, if you ask those people who left Tuvalu to be part of that Falapili arrangement, most of them will tell you that they are not running away because of climate change. They are making use of the opportunity to work. They are making use of the opportunity to get their children into education. And no climate narrative is attached to the Falapili. So it really shocking. You know, it's quite shocking for us to read that, you know, it seems how the article was framed. It was basically framed around the climate migrant narrative, which is really downplay the whole sovereignty and sovereign rights of people of Tuvalu to exist and to decide what is best for them. That is just a pathway, migration pathway, but not a climate pathway. People are not giving up. People are not moving because of climate change. Of course, we felt the impact of climate change, but that does not signal the international community that we are living too well because of climate change, because it has a lot of negative implications when we look into, because, you know, it takes away the dignity. It takes away the sovereignty of people. It really downplay the whole sovereignty narrative, you know, as to decide what is best for the people and for the community.
I wanted to, yeah, ask about, I guess, that narrative and the power of language. When the international media uses phrases like fleeing or disappearing islands or climate migrants, what impact do you see that have on a level in Tuvalu, on how Tuvaluans feel about it, but then also on a global level? Does it start to shift responsibility? Does it bring in the idea of inevitability, that Tuvalu will just eventually disappear to rising seas? How powerful is that language?
Yeah, the language, how strong the language is when it comes to, you know, Tuvalu will be completely disappeared in the next 50 years or so. It really shifted the responsibility. And especially, literally, we're telling the international community, you don't need to support us anymore. We are going down. We're sinking. Just open up your borders and let us in. This is a negative implication that, and this is a perspective from outside. People are looking from outside to inside saying, oh, Tuvalu is no longer inevitably suited for living in the next 50 years or so. So you need to migrate. You need to pack up and go. But that is not true. And this is not what we want. We want our sovereignty to be respected. We want our dignity to be respected by the international community, especially when it comes to the word anthropocentrism or anthropocentric. When they talk about the shift in responsibility, the international community is saying, oh, it's human make. So the responsibility should be well distributed among us. It's not just us in the international community. It's all human beings are responsible. And that is not true. That is not true because we are not responsible. Our contribution to climate change is almost next to nothing. It's 0.00001. And yet we have to suffer at the expense of the other. So the language that they are using, disappearance, climate migrants, climate refugees, how can we be called refugees for something that we did not cause? This is unfair and this is disrespectful.
What would you prefer to see? How do you want to see it framed?
I know right now, it's the migration pathway. It's a migration pathway. It's a matter of choice. Migration is a definite no for the people of Tuvalu, but it's a matter of choice. If you choose to leave, that's your own right to do whatever you wish to do. But it's not a collective decision by the country to leave because of climate change. So it's better to be framed as a migration pathway, whereby the government of Tuvalu will look into ways in which we ensure our people who go to Australia are well protected. They don't become second-class citizens in another country. And that is why we call it a pathway, because we talk to the Australian government. We discuss matters that, that will definitely infringe the rights of our people.
You talked there about colonial narratives, about the language that comes with talking about climate change, climate migrants, climate refugees. Just on the colonial narrative, when it comes to the Falapili Treaty itself in general, itself has been criticized for reinforcing a colonial narrative when it comes to security for Tuvalu, as Tuvalu must consult with Australia before entering into any agreement with another country. Some Tuvaluans themselves have criticized this, saying it does lead to Tuvalu giving up sovereignty. In that context of, colonial narratives, what do you say to that?
It's quite political now because I'm in government now and my hands are tied and my legs are tied as well. But let me frame it in a different way. When we talk about the colonial narrative, it's literally, we have sent our people across to Australia and to New Zealand under the palm schemes. So for me, before I became a minister or became a politician, I always look at those schemes in a way that our people are being recolonized in a different form. It's totally a recolonization process, but in a different nature, in a different phase, in a different form. But because I came in, we came into office, but the Falapili has already been decided. It's already been signed. And the opportunity for us to amend or to make some suggestions, it's very small, very, very small window, because whatever we will do, it will open up or trigger the whole treaty process for Australia. So what was made clear in cabinet and also in our discussion with the government of Australia, that the sovereignty, a bit of it, is still maintained. So only people that are, you know, we can criticize, of course. People have the right to criticize the Falepili Treaty, because there is no perfect treaty in this world. But I want to ensure our people to rest assured that the elements of sovereignty and our right to decide what is best for this country is not being taken away by the treaty. It's there. And that is why we made an appendix to the treaty itself, and to be read together with the treaty, to ensure that we explain explicitly the meaning of sovereignty and security in the treaty. So there is an attachment to the treaty to explain explicitly what do we mean by sovereignty, what do we mean by security. It doesn't mean that we have to ask Australia to give us permission to do what we want to do. We maintain that sovereignty, that dignity, as a country, to decide what is best for the people and for the nation.
Mm. We're coming to the end of 2025 now, heading into a new year, 2026. As Climate Change Minister, what's your top priority, especially when it comes to, like you say, you've got this narrative of Falepili with the migration pathway, concerns about the language of climate migrants, and then you're on the global stage urging still big polluting emitters to cut back on their greenhouse gas emissions for climate change. What's your main priority going into 2026 when it comes to climate change for Tuvalu?
My priority is very simple, and this is the priority of the government of Tuvalu, which we call it priority one and two. We talk about the rising seas and also climate change. But our priority, to make it simple, is that we want to build the resilience of our people, and building the resilience of our people, we want to build stronger in terms of our reclaim projects, because we have experienced negative impacts of climate change, especially sea level rise. So for us, in order for us to protect our people and their future and properties and so forth, is to continue to urge international community to invest in our reclamation projects. We call it the Tuvalu Climate Adaptation Project. So to build the resilience is to build the adaptation of projects on into. So that will be our priority for 2026. We can talk about different narrative. We can talk about so many things to climate, about climate change, about the ocean, about all these sexy things that people want to romanticize. But at the end of the day, we need financial support in order for us to build the resiliency of our people, given the very limited resources that we have. So we want to build adaptation, and to build adaptation is to build the resilience of our people.
That was Tuvalu's Climate Change Minister, Maina Taalia, speaking there.
ABC Radio Australia is the trusted voice in the Pacific, connecting our neighbours with news, music, sport and conversations for all ages.
The best thing that our two lead donor partners, Australia and New Zealand, can be doing right now is looking at vaccinating those in the Pacific.
Heated political and social commentary.
When you have news organisations that aren't interested in the facts, you worry.
The trusted voice in the Pacific, ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Monday morning. Now, 75 deportees from the United States will be resettled in Palau in the new year under a new multi-million dollar deal. Palau will get $7.5 million in funding for a new hospital in exchange for opening the door to third country nationals to live in the Pacific nation. But the deal, which was signed on Christmas Eve with the backing of Palau President Sorongil Whips Jr., comes on the back of opposition from Palau's Congress and the Council of Chiefs. And for more on this developing story, I'm joined by the publisher of Pacific Island Times, Marvik Kagurangan, who's been covering this story from Guam, where she is based. Marvik, welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning.
Marvik, tell me about this deal. Was the signing of this deal a surprise?
It was indeed a surprise. There was no media advisory for the event, which, as you mentioned, happened on Christmas Eve when Palawans were busy with their holiday preparations. And the initial announcement actually came from the State Department's very brief press release before the Office of the President posted its own statement on social media several hours later. And only a few cabinet members and two state governors were among the small group of officials at the signing ceremony. And other than them, no one else seemed to be aware that an agreement had already been reached with the U.S. State Department to transfer this third country national. So there was a leadership meeting on October 16 to discuss the proposal. And during that meeting, the president was trying to convince Palau leaders to get on board. But during that time, the Senate president and the Council of Chiefs rejected the U.S. proposal and advised the president against advancing the discussions with Washington. So no other meetings took place after October 16. So it came as a big surprise that to many that, you know, like a memorandum of understanding has already been signed.
And I understand that there were two memorandums of understanding that were signed. What did they mean?
This is only based on the press release from the office of the president. These documents have not been publicly released, but according to the press release, the first MOU refers to the relocation itself, the relocation of the 75 third country nationals. There's no details. The details are sketchy, no information about their nationalities, when exactly they will arrive and how long they will stay. And the second MOU refers to the corresponding assistance that Palau will receive from the U.S., which, you know, like as you reported, it involves a $7.5 million assistance to cover the cost of hosting these aliens in the hospital, plus $6 million for Palau's civil service pension system reform and $2 million for new law enforcement initiatives, among many others.
Since this was signed on Christmas Eve, like you say, it has been the Christmas period, so might have gone under the radar for some people in Palau. But what reaction have we seen from Palauans to this deal?
I spoke to one of the chief, one of the traditional chiefs, and he was surprised. He said that, you know, like they haven't had any meeting since October 16. So when they heard about this, it was like it was indeed a big surprise. And if you browse through social media comments, you'll see mixed sentiments among Palauans. There were people who categorically oppose this proposal. They think Palau is too small to accommodate such a big problem. But there are others who are open to the idea. Well, specifically, knowing that it comes with a new hospital, which is a big deal for a small country with, a poor healthcare system.
And you mentioned just before that there was that meeting back in October, but both Palau's Congress and the Council of Chiefs had called for President Sarungawepps Jr. to reject this proposal back then. How has President Sarungawepps Jr. framed this deal now that it has been signed and is going to be going underway?
Well, President Twips has been, he makes a pragmatic pitch by highlighting the supplemental funding and new hospital that the U.S. offers to provide. And he emphasizes that those who will be relocated to the country have no criminal history other than immigration issues. He also said that, you know, like part of the agreement is that Palau will be part of the vetting process, which means Palau will have a say on who can come and who cannot. Even the State Department emphasized this aspect of the agreement. And President Twips also hopes to be able to pick candidates who can join Palau's workforce to fill the gaps in certain job sectors.
This, though, isn't the first time that Palau has taken on US deportees. Back in 2009, Uyghur deportees were resettled in Palau. How did that experience back in 2009 turn out?
Well, they quietly left Palau in 2015 because they didn't fit in. Their job skills didn't have a market in Palau. But, you know, when they left, the final destination was not disclosed.
So now with this deal being signed and we're going to see more third country nationals coming in from the US here in 2025, what fallout do you expect to see from these 75 deportees and the deal being made now?
You know, even before the MOU was signed, there was already a clash of opinions among different branches of government. So it's more likely to escalate into power tensions and raise the questions about the president's authority to enter into an agreement with the U.S. without congressional approval. So, yes, this is like a brewing political drama.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it all unfolds. And of course, Mavic, you'll be reporting on it. So I'm sure we'll be in touch. Mavic Kagurang, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you and good morning.
That was the publisher of Pacific Islands Time, Mavic Kagurang, speaking to me there. My name is Jordan Fennell. This is Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. I hope you're having a lovely start to your Monday morning. If you are still on holidays, I hope it's been a relaxing time. And if you are back at work, then we are in this together. This morning, already on Pacific Beat, Palau's President Soronga Whipps Jr. has signed a deal on Christmas Eve allowing 75 US deportees to be resettled in Palau. You heard just there from Mavic Kagurangan. And also today on Pacific Beat, you've heard about Tuvalu's climate minister who has slammed the use of the term climate migrants when it comes to talking about Tuvaluans. Now, you can catch up on all those stories online. You can search ABC Pacific or type Pacific Beat into your favorite search engine. Now, still to come on the show, Islands Business International has named Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Rekinvanu, as their person of the year. And in just a moment, Islands Business editor Nathani Rika will join me to chat about why they chose him. And a little later, tech news out of Papua New Guinea, Google is set to build 3 more undersea cables. And as the use of Starlink hangs in the balance, PNG's Communications Authority has put out a press release saying it's all up to the courts. Every year, Time magazine selects a Person of the Year award, recognizing their influence on the world over the past year. In 2024, Donald Trump won the award after winning the US election in what was an historical political comeback. In the Pacific, we have our own version of the award run each year by the Fiji-based publishing group Islands Business International. This year, Vanuatu climate change minister and global climate campaigner Ralph Rekinvanu is the Islands Business Person of the Year. And joining me this morning to tell me more about this prestigious award and explain why Mr. Rekinvanu is this year's recipient is Islands Business editor Nathani Rika. Good morning, Nathani.
Good morning.
Nathani, Oh, thank you. Merry Christmas to you as well. Before we chat about this year's winner, tell me a little bit about how long has Islands Business been running this award and what's it all about?
We've been around more than 50 years, and this award is about recognizing Pacific people for their contributions to the region and also to the world. And many times that begins in their own countries. I think the Pacific is often neglected when it comes to the contributions it makes to international affairs, to the world, and in the case of Ralph Rekinvanu of Vanuatu, to the environment. and to the protection of our home.
And what's the criteria? How do you go about selecting who will win?
We look at the impact that the Pacific people have made in their own countries and in the region and internationally. People have who stand out, and let's say we look at the time and the effort and the passion and the ingenuity and the sometimes even the recognition that has been given them by people from outside their own countries or outside the region. We are looking for outstanding people.
Yeah, and you mentioned there that with Mr. Reginvanu, the environment was part of that process of why you chose him. What else was it about what Mr. Reginvanu had done this year that made him your top pick for this year's award?
It's really about his consistency. He's the only Pacific leader who has actually made real progress and real contributions to climate change. His work has not been merely words. It's been about living Pacific ideals of unity, of caring for others. He's also really been involved with the young people of the Pacific in their journey to create a safer and more sustainable Pacific for everyone.
And do you give Mr. Reginvanu a call to let him know he's the winner? Is there a process where you speak to him about this?
No, we don't do it that way. We choose a person and we publish the story about them. We name the person as our Pacific Person of the Year.
Were there any other contenders up for the top pick?
It came down to whether we chose one person or the entire team that took climate change to the International Court of Justice for the Pacific. And so I think that two, Mr. Reginvanu and the young people of the Pacific, sort of intertwined there. But there was for us, I think, no single Pacific leader who stood out as a person of such substance as Mr. Reginvanu.
He was definitely everywhere during that ICJ court case, leading the charge, fronting the media. As that was all happening, of course, US President Donald Trump had quite a huge influence on international politics, regularly talking about climate skepticism. Do you think climate champions like Mr. Reginvanu will become even more important in the Pacific's future, facing an international arena where there's one leaders like Donald Trump?
What I'd say is it's important for Pacific leaders to be like Mr. Reginvanu and to stand up to skeptics, to be a voice for the voiceless Pacific, even when it's very difficult. A lot of our leaders, I feel, put their own interests first, or they don't see climate change as important enough to make a principal stand against some bigger countries, which means that the work they do will be influenced by, say, Mr. Trump's view on climate change, and if that's too uncomfortable to deal with, they're not going to be very vocal about this issue. Mr. Reginvanu is one of the few people in the Pacific who is willing to make sacrifices, I suppose, to lose over with this issue, which is a huge threat to all of us. We need more people like him to stand up to international pressure and to let the world know that this is something that for the people of the Pacific.
Well, Netani Rika, thank you so much for joining me this morning and chatting about the island's business international person of the year, Ralph Reginvanu. That was Netani Rika, editor for Islands Business, speaking to me there.
This New Year's Eve, ABC Radio Australia is throwing the biggest party in the Pacific. From 4 p.m. PNG time, Jacob McGuire and Michael Chow from Nisha Daily, Sosef Uomoli from Sister Sounds and On The Record, Hal Lattel-Kerful from In The Fale, and Rick Howe from Island Music pump out non-stop party anthems. Wherever you are, from Majuro to Port Moresby, celebrate the countdown to 2026 with us. ABC Radio Australia's New Year's Eve party this Wednesday from 4 p.m. PNG time.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, some tech news out of Papua New Guinea. Google is set to build subsea cables in PNG under its defence treaty with Australia. The US $120 million infrastructure project is part of the Puk Puk connectivity initiative that the PNG government says will make the country a regional digital anchor. And as Papua New Guineans await the court's ruling on whether Starlink can be used in the country, PNG's communications authority has released a statement on its position. I spoke with Dr. Amanda Watson, ANU Pacific Affairs Department communications researcher, for more.
So what we know from the Papua New Guinea Minister for Information and Communications Technology, the Honourable Peter Chiamalili Jr., is that there's going to be three new undersea cables to Papua New Guinea funded by Australia. And according to him, he says they'll provide high capacity connectivity. And he suggests that the locations where these three new cables would connect would be one to the northern side of Papua New Guinea, one to the southern side of Papua New Guinea, and a third one to the autonomous region of Bougainville.
And on Bougainville, tell me, how will this impact, I guess, the people of Bougainville and sort of their access to connectivity with this particular cable?
So for me, it makes sense to have a cable specifically for the autonomous region of Bougainville. We know that at the moment, negotiations are underway about Bougainville's political future. Those negotiations are ongoing. And it seems to me that whether Bougainville becomes an independent country or has special autonomy status within Papua New Guinea, either way, it makes sense that there'd be a cable connecting directly to Bougainville to give data connectivity to Bougainville. And in addition to that, perhaps that data from that cable entry point could then be passed on to other island areas in Papua New Guinea via domestic cables, perhaps.
And one of the big things as well out of this announcement is that Google is going to be building these subsea cables. What's the significance of a big tech company like Google delivering this infrastructure to PNG?
I'm not completely surprised about this because in recent years, companies such as Google and Amazon Web Services have entered the cable industry. And this has been a shift in the industry because up until recent years, such cables were not engaged in cable infrastructure projects. But for this particular project for Papua New Guinea, I'm unclear about how Google was chosen. And I'm not sure whether there was a transparent tender process undertaken by the Australian government, which is funding the project. Perhaps there might be an argument made that because Google is already working on laying cables in the Pacific Islands region at this time, that there might be possible cost savings. But that information hasn't been made public. It's unclear how and why Google was chosen for this particular project and whether other companies had a chance to compete.
This is all happening, of course, under the Australian Defence Treaty with PNG, the Puk Puk Treaty. This treaty gives Australian defence personnel some access to PNG communication systems, things like satellite stations and cables. With this convergence of commercial tech infrastructure and security agreements, what does this mean for PNG's digital sovereignty?
Yes, you're right. So the Puk Puk Treaty, which is this mutual defence treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea that was signed in October this year, it has Article 11, which is the one that refers to communication access. And in Article 11, it indicates that Australian Defence Force personnel can install and operate radio, satellite and cable systems. And also in Article 11, it mentions that they can access and use electromagnetic spectrum. Point two of Article 11 makes the point that the two countries would need to consult one another about the use of frequencies, which makes sense because these are things that are regulated by the countries so that we don't have interference. For instance, you don't want a mobile phone service to interfere with a television broadcast, for instance. So these things do have the frequencies do have to be coordinated. In terms of what the convergence means, I think that I am not sure, but I can imagine that this kind of thing happens elsewhere. That is the convergence between commercial, technical, private company infrastructure and security arrangements or military uses of such technology. I imagine that it might happen in other places. I think one thing that I'm unclear about what it really means, but I guess at least one thing that's good is that we have some transparency here. So we have the full text of the treaty available. We can look at, any member of the public can find the treaty quite easily through doing an internet search, and then they can look at the treaty and decide themselves whether they think that's a good thing or not. So whilst I imagine that some people might have questions about it, at least it's being done in a transparent way, and we're being told what the arrangements would be.
Peter Chimalili Jr. has said that this new announcement, these subsea cables, it's going to make PNG, he says, a regional digital anchor. What do you make of that statement? Is that accurate?
Well, first of all, I would say that there is a lot of activity happening with regard to cables being laid in the Pacific Islands region at this time. The cable map is fast evolving and changing, so I think it would be a good idea to hold back on making judgment until we have a full picture of all the various cable initiatives that are happening at this time. I do think that it's hard to envisage, though, that Papua New Guinea would be a regional digital anchor, as the current communication minister has said, because there's so many challenges in Papua New Guinea. The first one that springs to mind is electricity access. And if you are wanting to be a regional digital anchor, presumably you want to have data centres and people able to secure jobs in data centres and digital sort of e-government services and things like that. With most people struggling with electricity access in Papua New Guinea, and even those who are connected having frequent outages, it's hard to imagine how Papua New Guinea could be a regional digital anchor. And then on top of that, there's all these other challenges in Papua New Guinea, such as terrain, development level, law and order, education level of people, and so on. So I find it hard to envisage that Papua New Guinea would be a regional digital anchor, but he doesn't put a time frame on that. So maybe at some future point it may be possible. I'm not sure.
Now, staying on the topic of digital connectivity, over the last year, some Papua New Guineans have been using Starlink, the satellite internet, which is not actually formally licensed to be used in PNG. And actually, earlier this month, PNG's Communications Authority instructed SpaceX, the parent company of Starlink, to stop the use of Starlink in PNG while a court case about this issue continues to unfold. Now, PNG's Communications Authority has put out a press release about this. What did they have to say?
The low Earth orbit internet service Starlink has been spreading around the Pacific, but it's currently not able to be used. It's technically illegal to use Starlink in Papua New Guinea at the moment because it hasn't been licensed, and we're continuing to await the outcome of a court case on the licensing of Starlink's satellite internet service. So the court case is still happening. We're still awaiting the judge's decision regarding that court case. The regulator, which is the independent telecommunication regulator called NICTA, they've put out a press release basically pretty much in summary saying it's not our fault. The court case is ongoing. So really just, I think they must be getting some backlash, and they've tried to explain what's going on by just letting people know that they're not holding back the Starlink license. It's this court case that was brought about by the Ombudsman Commission that is the issue.
And Starlink has become quite popular around the Pacific for providing internet services, even in remote areas. How do undersea cables, like the one that Google is going to build for PNG, compare to Starlink when it comes to connectivity around the region?
Undersea cables provide reliable bandwidth, and much of the world's internet traffic goes through undersea cables. So it's my feeling that this will continue to be the case, even though Starlink is very popular in the Pacific at the moment because it's new and it's providing internet access in certain places where internet access might not have been available before in places around the Pacific. But my feeling is that even though there's Starlink and there's other low Earth orbit satellite internet services that are going to become available, I think nonetheless undersea cables will continue to be really important as a valuable, reliable backbone to telecommunications systems around the world, including in the Pacific.
And that was ANU communications researcher Dr. Amanda Watson speaking to me there.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Now, the Arona Cup, Sharks versus the Roosters. I did say that.
Arona Cup every week, man. Honestly, yeah, it was just the grand final of the week. Now, I swear, I don't know how many times we played for this cup.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? PolyTalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on PolyTalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. A quick look back at our main stories today. 75 deportees from the United States will be resettled in Palau in the new year under a new multi-million dollar deal. And Tuvalu's climate change minister has slammed the labelling of Tuvaluans as climate migrants as disrespectful and colonial. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily.